Luke chapter 21, verse 5 says, "As some," these are his disciples, "spake of the temple, how it was adorned with goodly, with beautiful stones and gifts." Now, Matthew tells us that as they are leaving the temple precincts, that Jesus, no doubt with great emotion, he had wept over Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. The word means he had convulsed. Now he says, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem," when he says something twice, you listen. When he says to me, "Joseph, Joseph," you listen. "Verily, verily," you listen. "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that stonest the prophets and killest those that are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thee unto myself as a hen gathers the chickens under her wings, but you would not. And now, behold, your house is left unto you desolate, and henceforth you shall see me no more until you say, Blessed is he who cometh in the name of the Lord." And his disciples were shocked at that statement, and that is what they are reacting to, and that is where this question comes from, when they're saying, "Lord, but look at the stones, look at the temple, look at the scene that is before you." But Jesus, you know, didn't see the outward form of religion, the beauty of the temple, and admire that. He saw that Israel at that time was basically a spiritual wasteland. They had taken all that had been given to them in regards to privilege, and the religious leaders of the day had been so negligent and self-serving and self-seeking that they were empty, as it were. And Jesus knows that when a nation, and it's important for our nation to understand, when a nation is a spiritual wasteland, that it's only a matter of time before it becomes a physical wasteland. And Jesus, looking at this scene, says, "Your house will be left desolate." The disciples are shocked. They said, "Lord, but look at these magnificent stones. Look what is going on here." Now, the temple had been in construction for about 40 years at that point in time. It was one of the wonders of the world. The Talmud says, and written by rabbis who detested Herod and the Romans, if you haven't seen Herod's temple, you have never seen a building. Today, when you go to Jerusalem, remarkably, the rabbi's tunnel is open now. I've been there a number of times in that tunnel, and there's a stone down there that's 45 feet long, 12 foot wide, and it varies in height. It's 750 tons, they estimated at, one single stone. The bottom of that stone was cut in the shape of the bedrock it would be placed upon, and when it was placed there, it fit on the bedrock, the top of it level, the ends of it vertical. And there's so many stones, they're still there, oh, in the open, 20 foot long, 5 foot high, 8 foot thick. And you can't put the blade of a penknife between the stones. They're set without mortar. The temple courts themselves were made of white marble, imported. The columns and the temple building itself made of white marble. Now, Herod the Great said, he was only about 4'8", and he loved big stones. He said that he wanted to build something that would outlive the pyramids. And if you have studied the pyramids, know anything, particularly the Great Pyramid at Giza, we see there now a limestone. It's the largest building on earth, by the way. The base of it covers 13 acres, 2,300,000 stones, average weight of a ton and a half, many bigger. But originally, that pyramid was covered with white marble stones that fit into the steps, and it had smooth sides. You would slide down it. There was no way you could scale it. It was pure white marble, and they believed the very top was made of gold. Now, Herod, determining to build a structure that would outlive the pyramids, builds this temple of pure white marble. the doors covered, overlaid with pure gold, the pinnacle of the temple, all around the top of the temple structure, not the pinnacle of the temple court, gold all around the top, tons and tons and tons of pure gold. And all up at the top, it was made with sharp points all over it so no pigeons or birds could land there because they were dirty. And the religious Jews considered them dirty. So there was no bird that could land up there. There were too many gold spikes all around the top. You can see a model of it today. Josephus gives us great details. The Talmud talks about it. A remarkable structure. In fact, one of the writers in the Talmud said that if you were to look at the temple when the sun was rising or the sun was setting, you could barely keep your eyes open because it hurt your eyes. It was so bright between the white marble and the gold all over it, you could hardly look at the building. And many of the Jews looked at that and said, that means God is blessing us. That outward sign right there in construction for 40 years at that point in time is a sign to us that God's blessing is on our nation. Jesus walking out of it says, behold, your house is left unto you desolate. To the Jew, that didn't mean empty. That meant ruin. They understood what desolation was. The Babylonians had left them desolate. Well, they say, Lord, but look at the stones. Look at this place. Look at these temple. They think it's impossible what he's saying. Considering the foundation stones, many of the stones, 150 tons. You just don't, you know, what do you mean, Lord? What's going to happen here? Looking at its strength and its beauty. But Jesus sees something completely different than they do. He's not impressed with the beauty of this building. Now, of course, when you come from heaven, it's hard to impress you anyway. But he wasn't impressed because he could see the future. He knew that within 40 years, Jerusalem, the temple would be gone. The Romans would drag a plow over Jerusalem. He sees it completely different than they do. Not impressed with it at all. What he's saying to them is, I don't want you to think the way everybody else thinks when you look at this present situation. I don't want you to find security in the things that worldly human beings find security in. That's what he's saying to them. They say in verse 5, Lord, look at the temple. Look how beautifully it's adorned. Look at the beautiful stones. And the treasures people are bringing into it. He said, as for these things which you behold, they weren't the things that he was beholding something different. The days will come in the which there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Now, that sounded impossible. And imagine, you know, looking at Washington. All you need to do is turn the news on today and you see Washington. The Capitol building, the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Monument, the White House. Imagine if someone told you, not one brick, not one stone here, but not too distant future, will be left standing. This place will be leveled. Now, I think in the back of our minds, because we're 20th century Christians, we hold the idea of nuclear war ideas, but I still think that would be a shock. That would be hard for us to swallow. That would be something that would be staggering to us, I think. 70 AD, within 40 years, the Jews revolting against Rome draw into the city, shut the gates, draw back into the temple precincts because of its strength and its power. Titus Vespasian surrounds the city with the 5th, 10th, and 12th Roman legions, all battle-hardened, green berets, experienced soldiers. The siege, they knew it would be long, goes on over a year and a half. They cut off all supplies. They cut off all the water they could cut off. Within a year, mothers inside the city are eating their children. They're throwing the dead bodies over the wall to try to keep the plague down inside the city. Titus Vespasian, who was not a believer, is recorded as saying, God, don't hold me accountable for this. He met with the Jews, the leaders, close to the end of the siege and said, please, I don't want to have to destroy the temple to get you out of there. I don't want to have to burn it down. I don't want to see it destroyed. Will you surrender now that for the sake of your temple?" And I don't know whether he held it in some kind of regard. I don't know what was going on in his own heart. But he said, "Please, will you surrender so this doesn't happen?" They refused. The Roman soldiers are furious. In an evening, several Roman soldiers broke through a breach in the wall, and unexpected, they met no resistance all the way to the temple courts. One soldier stands on the shoulders of another soldier and throws a torch into the window of the temple building, and a fire starts. Vespasian is awakened, comes to the temple courts. By then, the soldiers are pouring in. He is yelling for them to stop, not to burn the temple. Soldiers listening to him scream, and in such a frenzy, they think he's saying to burn, and torches started to go in, and the whole temple was engulfed in flames. The inside of it lined with wood. And as that temple heated up, all of the gold around the top, the perimeter, tons of gold on the doors and around the windows melted and ran down between the stones. There was no mortar. Now, at the end of the siege, there were over 1 million dead, close to that many carried away as slaves to Egypt, to Rome. But part of the salary that the Roman soldiers took to themselves, they were allowed to take the spoil from a siege. To get the gold out from between the stones, they started to pry the stones apart with iron pry bars, hundreds of soldiers on a stone, flipping it off and then scraping whatever gold they could get out from between the stones. And by the time they were done, there was not one stone left upon another that was not cast down. Now, it's very remarkable today, the excavations off the Western Wall. When you go to the Valley of Tophet there, the Cheesemaker's Valley, they have excavated all the way down, and it is remarkable to see stones there, half as big as this stage and 5 foot higher. You see these remarkable stones crushed on top of marketplace booths, and you can see the excavators left them right where they were knocked down off the wall and cast down into the street. Those stones, a mute testimony to the fact that Jesus knows exactly what's coming. Now, when he told them, "Not one stone will be left upon another that will not be thrown down," he was not guessing. He knew. Now, that makes this a very important preface to the material that we're going to move into, because when he spoke about our day, he saw that as clearly as he saw 40 years into the future. He could see 2,000 years into the future. And what he told us would take place is exactly what will take place in our day, and it's very important for us to understand that. And those excavations there, if you ever get a chance, are remarkable. And certainly a testimony. And I'll tell you this, too. Our world, as I look at it, looks a lot more shaky than that temple looked to those Jews in that day. As I look at the world today, coming apart at the seams, disintegrating, it doesn't look as stable as Jesus' own disciples thought that temple looked when they looked at it in their day. And Jesus has many things to say about the world that we live in, too. Now, he says, "There will not be one stone left here upon another that will not be thrown down." That draws from them a question. They ask him, saying, "Master, when shall these things be? And what sign will there be when these things shall come to pass?" Matthew tells us that they add, "And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the age?" So it's kind of fourfold, this question. When shall these things be? What shall be the sign when these things will come to pass? What shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the age? He said, and in all three places where he answers this question, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he begins with this: "Take heed that you be not deceived, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and the time draweth near, go ye not therefore after them." Now, We're going to talk more about spiritual deception as we move on a little further in the chapter. All of these places, when Jesus talks about his return, the end of the age, there is a warning about spiritual deception. That's what he begins with in each place, very important. That will culminate, by the way, in the Antichrist, the greatest spiritual deception the world has seen. As we read the verse, some people say, well, what is he saying? That people are going to come and say that they are the Christ and deceive people? Or that people are going to come and say that Jesus is the Christ and deceive people? Well, you know what? Both. And I think that's why it's written this way. Some people are going to come on the scene and say they're the Christ. It's estimated that in Hollywood, there are 90 new messiahs a month. Just in Hollywood. Not in the movie industry. Just showing up on Wilshire Boulevard and Hollywood Boulevard. They say 90 new people show up a month saying that they're Jesus. Bob Coy was telling me, I talked to him on the phone last week, Calvary Chapel down in Fort Lauderdale. He said about a month ago, at the end of the service, he was inviting people to come forward and accept Christ. And he said, for some reason that night, I said, I want you to come forward. I want to introduce you to Jesus. And he said, after I said about three times, he said, a woman walked down, walked up on the stage and stood next to me. And he said, everybody's looking. You know, people are coming forward. This, you know, very uncomfortable moment. I said, can I help you? And she said, well, I'm the Messiah. And you just told the people here you'd like to introduce them to Jesus, so I figure I better come up here. And the guys took her away. You know, there she is, the Messiah just got, you know. Well, there's a lot of people out there saying that's who they are and what they are. From Sai Baba to Rajneesh, Guru Maharaji came on the scene in the early 70s saying he was the Messiah, the Divine Light Mission. Didn't deliver, started to get into cheeseburgers and stewardesses and women and wine. And his older brother got angry and said then that he was the Lord of the universe because his younger brother was blowing it. They end up going to court suing each other to see who really was the Lord of the universe. Now that may sound funny to you, but I was stupid enough to go to New York and stand in line for 3 days to receive knowledge from Guru Maharaj in 1970, 69, whatever. It's all a blur. It's all a blur. And then there's a lot of people coming on the scene who agree with you and I that are going to say Jesus is the Christ, but have another agenda. Wolves. Taking advantage of God's people, taking advantage of the flock. You know them by their fruit. And we'll come to that. And Jesus says this to them. When you shall hear of wars and commotions, be not terrified. Now that's a little different than be not deceived. You know, I can see, hey, I study the scripture, I'm trying to stay up on things, keep my spiritual eyes open, I'm into be not deceived. But when I start reading about some of these things that are coming, be not terrified, it's just a little harder to swallow for me. Be not terrified, for these things must come to pass. The end is not yet, not by and by. Nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And great earthquakes shall be in diverse places, and famines, and pestilences, and fearful sights, and great signs shall there be from heaven. Now, when we read this in both Matthew and Mark, Jesus then says, but these are the beginning of sorrows. That's a very important phrase. And these are the beginning, literally, of birth pains, of the pains of sorrow, of childbirth. That's important to you and I because, look, in one sense, as we sit here this evening and we talk about the return of Christ, what we're saying is not new. The church has been talking about the return of Christ since its inception. Paul told the single men in his day, in 1 Corinthians 7, stay single. If you get married, you have to worry about the needs of your wife. If you stay single, you can worry about the things of Christ. And this is not the Lord, but it's my opinion. If you do that, you're better off, he says, because the Lord's coming soon. Now imagine if the whole church would have stayed single in the first century. That would have been the end of the church. But Paul was expecting him. When he talks in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, beginning at 13, about the resurrection, the coming of Christ, being caught up to meet him in the air, he says, so shall we, personal pronoun, including himself, be caught up to meet him in the air. So shall we ever be with the Lord. He expected the Lord to come in his time. So that is not a new idea. You know, your grandmother, your grandfather will say to you, hey, they've been saying that since I'm a kid. My grandmother said that to me. She's in heaven now. She knows I'm right. But she said it to me. You know, people walking down the street with a sandwich board, repent, the end is near. Well, there's two things that are very different about this evening than my grandmother's day. One is this, the rebirth of the nation of Israel. None of these things could take place without the rebirth of the nation of Israel. A miracle within itself, and we'll talk about that as we go on. Through the Middle Ages of the church, because Israel, for all intent and purposes, had disappeared, many, and understandably, had tried to take the promises made to Israel and overlay them on the church. But of course, it didn't work with all of them, because some of them seem so literal and geographical, and they are. There were authors insightful enough to say, this doesn't work. I believe. I enjoy reading C.H. McIntosh because in 1860 he said Israel's going to have to be reborn as a nation. Joseph Zeiss, in his commentary written in the 1860s on the book of Revelation, says we're going to have to see Israel reborn as a nation. Remarkable to read these guys, insightful enough to say, hey, this is going to happen. Israel's going to be reborn. That's one. Israel is the key to God's calendar prophetically. Back in the land again. If you don't believe me, watch the news when you go home. Second thing that's very important. This is the first generation that stands in a place to completely eliminate itself. Jesus, in fact, said if he wouldn't return when he did, there would be no flesh left alive on the planet. Now, you have to understand, in the Civil War 100 years ago, we lost probably higher casualties than any of our other wars. But there was not a chance of the Union and Confederate Army wiping out every human being on the planet. It just was not going to happen. It wasn't going to happen when the English pulled out their longbows and freaked everybody out. But now we stand in a place where that can happen. Now, the early 80s, if you want to be encouraged, the early 80s, they estimated, when the Cold War was on, they estimated that between us and the Soviet Union and Great Britain and France and the nations at that time that had nuclear weapons, the early 80s, they estimated that there was a 17 Earth arsenal. What that meant was the combined detonating potential of those nations could destroy every inch on the planet 17 times over, in case they didn't do it the first 16 times. Now today, the United States is down to a 5-Earth arsenal, somewhere in there. Russia down to a 3-4-Earth arsenal, in case I'm trying to encourage you, see. But we're the first generation that really has the potential to do that to ourselves, and no generation has ever lived on this planet that has not used the weapons that they've developed. Now before we're done, I'm going to show you that I am not a pessimist, I'm an optimist. It doesn't sound like it so far, I know. But I am. Jesus said there would be wars, rumors of wars. You're going to hear about this. Imagine that. These things must come to pass. Don't be terrified. The end is not by and by. Then he said unto them, nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. He's speaking of worldwide states of war, which is very interesting because it's been this century is the first time we've really seen that take place. World War II. The whole world involved. Now the key is, look, as we look at wars, earthquakes, famine, pestilence, all of these things with Israel back in the land happening at the same time produce birth pains. when, you know, my wife has delivered four babies. I've cheered her on. And I was eyewitness to all of those births. And as you go through the process, there's a period of Braxton Hicks contractions where your wife goes, especially with the first one, because you're not sure, you know, ooh, hey, you know, no, calm down. It's just a Braxton Hicks. Well, what in the world is a Braxton Hicks? It's just kind of a fake early contraction. Just, okay, just, you know, but as this goes on, there's no doubt something's happening. Now, Jesus says the last days are going to be like a woman at 42 weeks, 2 weeks overdue in the middle of August. No air conditioning. That's the way it's going to get. Don't do that. He says, it will be like a woman in birth pains. When you see wars and rumors of wars, famine, pestilence, which deadly infectious diseases, that's the word. Pestilence, earthquakes, when you see these things all increasing in frequency and intensity at the same time, then you got a situation developing. You are in transition. You are in full-blown labor at that point in time. And that's what we're seeing. Now, there's no way I'm going to get through all of these this evening, but we'll look at this idea of wars and rumors of wars, worldwide states of war, and war increasing. World War II. 32 million people died on battlefields. World War II. 32 million died on battlefields. Now just imagine this, because, you know, when Jesus is brokenhearted over Jerusalem, a little over a million die and a million carried away. This is 32 million human beings dead on battlefields. 25 million civilians died in World War II in bombings in cities. 25 million people died in World War II as either prisoners of wars or in concentration camps. 25 million. That's 82 million so far. 29 million were wounded or mutilated. Estimated cost. Speaking of cost, it cost the Allies $225,000 per kill. $225,000 for each enemy killed. Now, that's not cost effective, so we've really improved that. We can really aim now. Get the job done. Now, imagine that. 82 million people dead. Today, in Europe, the World Atlas says there are 32 million soldiers in the world today on active duty. 32 million on active duty. 570 million more in reserves. Now think of what we're saying here. We're up at 32 million in active duty, 570 million soldiers on reserve. 50% of all the world's scientists are working on weapons. 40% of all money spent in the area of science goes towards some form of weapons research and development. Now, think of the statistics I just gave you. World War II, 32 million died on the battlefield, 25 million civilians died in bombings, 25 million in concentration camps or as prisoners of war. Today, the christening of the United States submarine, USS Pennsylvania, $3 billion submarine. It carries 24 missiles. This is one submarine. 24 missiles. Each missile has 15 separate independently targeted warheads. One ship, this one submarine, has 40 times the detonating power of every weapon fired by every side in World War II. Now, you understand what I'm saying? World War II, 32 million died on battlefields, 25 million died as civilians in cities, 25 million died in concentration camps. That's with all of the fighting, of all of the sides. Today, one single submarine, 40 times the detonating power of all the munitions detonated from the enemy, from the Americans, from all sides, one submarine. That's a scary thought. I don't know, you know, this evening, what your hope is in. You know, we're going to offer you some hope before the evening's over because we know how all this is going to pan out. Imagine having these statistics and not being a Christian. That would really be a bummer. If I was not a Christian and I had these statistics, I would understand people who move away to the mountains and store guns and rice. No, I don't suggest that. If things get hard, I'm a Christian. Somebody's coming across my front lawn to get some rice, I can't shoot them. I gotta love them. I'm a Christian. We are making presently 90 nuclear warheads per day on this planet. Today, at 6 billion people, they estimate that for every human being on Earth, there are 40 tons of TNT. Just when you go to bed tonight, just enjoy that. That's how important you are. 40 tons of TNT for every human being on the planet. And there is a sophisticated weapon, not counting rifles or handguns, for every person on the planet. Now, think of the tension today. Wars and rumors. Jesus said, you're going to hear commotion. It's going to be building in intensity. Ireland, Cambodia, Colombia, the Congo, the Persian Gulf, Sierra Leone, the Balkans, Serbia, Bosnia, Afghanistan, the Sudan, Sri Lanka, Chechnya, Lebanon, El Salvador, Peru, India, and Pakistan. And we watch it night after night. And we stand in the danger. I will speak for myself. I stand in the danger of those becoming images on a television and being desensitized to the truth of the world we live in because I live in this American illusion. And I can let it slip through my thinking process and not get a hold of the fact that they are families, they're moms and dads. Same IQ, would do just as good in an SAT as we would, could do just as good at our job as we could, would love to have a refrigerator just like we do, wish they had a changing table for their baby and air conditioning and water, just a glass full of clean water without bacteria. Their grandparents and little kids that are orphaned. That's the world. That we live in. Wandering scenes in Africa of 100,000 people on the move with everything they own strapped on their back, holding their kids, starving, looking for a place to sit down where they're not going to get hit with a weapon, looking for an hour of stability, looking for what we live and take for granted. Now, as I talk about these things, I'm not talking about these things as, you know, this is not just your screwball pastor with a Hawaiian shirt. Is giving you this is history. These are statistics. This is irrefutable. I was out about a month ago or so, a little more than that. We have staff meeting Monday morning. Middle of staff meeting, Judy interrupts. Normally she doesn't do that. The Pentagon's on the phone. So I go out, naval commander. Hey, I'm involved with 15 Bible studies down here in Washington. Over 247 believers. We listen to your tapes every week. We listen to all of Chuck Missler's updates. We listen to your tapes. We're getting ready to start a series on the life of Christ, so we sent them all of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all the tapes down. I said, when you're up here sometime, let me know. Well, he was up at the Promise Keepers a couple of weeks ago. We had a chance to sit and talk. Downside is, he says, the morale is low. People that have been there for years that gave a genuine concern about national defense are being discouraged, disheartened. I said, how prepared do you think we are? Not very. I said, our only hope is for a God-given revival, for an awakening in the church. I said, how optimistic are you about this situation we're approaching January 31st, December 31st, 1999, 520 days from now? You should know about it. You hear the acronyms Y2K, Y year, 2K is 1,000, year 2000, the millennial bug. Now it's in Harvard Business Journal, Time Magazine, everywhere you look. About 7 months ago, I formed a board here of church of people that are very heavily involved in the industry, some of them doing the Y2K projects for multi-billion dollar international corporations, for the IRS, for different parts of our government, and said, you know, out of concern, because I think, well, what do we say to each other as we get closer? Now, for any of you who I encourage you all to get educated on the internet. You can read about it. Problem is, we made our computers, and because when they started to build computers, space was so precious, they set up the date system with the last two numbers. So today is 8/5/98. We're moving towards the computers encountering 1/1/0/0, which they've never seen before. And they're not set up to deal with it. A large percent of them are going back to 1900. And you're going to stop getting your social security checks because they're going to think you're not born yet. The people are scrambling to try to straighten this out. Europe is working on the euro dollar so fervently. I had an opportunity to be with an international tax accountant, a cousin of my mother's who was over here to America for the first time in his 60s, working on the euro dollar project. And he said, we are aware of Y2K, but we can't slow down to take care of that or we'll be stuck with two problems. We want to try to push the euro dollar forward. Now they're running into all kinds of problems. They say there's something like 300,000 switch tracks across the country that are date sensitive chips in them. They used to be run by hand. Switch a track. Everybody was on a schedule. Wonderful thing. They're automated. They have date-sensitive chips. And a certain time during the day, the track switches and things are delivered to stores and loading docks. They're all going to go haywire, not know what to do. A man from Washington told me if we put everybody on it right now, the Defense Department would be ready in 2006. He said, we're hoping to have our major systems running. Now, the talk we hear on this issue is from the end of Western civilization to complete ignorance. Don't even worry about it. No. Let me tell you, it's not going to be the end of Western civilization. And it's not going to be a nothing either. You need to know about it. You need to think about it. I don't know where it's going to go. I know that a whole power grid shut down somewhere as they tested dates. Someone here from Temple Hospital and Temple University, their fiscal year ends in July, told me they put in an order for August 99, which took into the year 2000, and all of the computers in both places that deal with the business locked up and shut down. And it's going to cost them $25 million to be ready. And they said they'll be ready. Will it just blow by us with some inconveniences? I don't know. Will your electric company go down? I don't know. Chuck Missler's wife is related to an executive, I believe, from, well, one of the major oil corporations, one of the biggies. And he said, her relative, we have miles of pipe pumping oil all over. He said, there are valves all over with date-sensitive chips in them. We won't know till the date hits which ones aren't ready. He said, we can't dig up untold miles of pipe, some of it 30 foot deep, to change everything now. We go out of business. He said, some of this we're going to have to wait till it happens and see if the oil valves lock up. The problem is, of course, the ones run through Alaska. Once the oil stands still and starts to congeal, you've got big problems moving it again. And we're going to be in the winter. And just our luck, El Nino is going away, and his cold sister, La Nina, is coming back. I would suggest that if you are insulin dependent, or you need a prescription of something for your daily health, that you stockpile a month or two. This man from the Pentagon told me, I think a month's worth of dry goods and water is just prudent at this point with floods and tornadoes and everything else that's going on. But it may change your lives. Now, to tell you the truth, I'm hoping for one of two things, because I know the answer to all this. I talked to Chuck Smith last week, and I said, Chuck, what are you doing? Are you guys preparing for Y2K? What do you think of it, and what are you doing, and how are you getting ready for this problem as it's coming? He said, oh, I'm memorizing Psalm 46. God is our refuge and our strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will not we fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. He said, I'm getting ready. I'm hoping personally for the return of Jesus Christ. The world that we live in is armed to the teeth. 1995, I have the memo here, and it wasn't advertised widely. Norwegians fired off a weather satellite. The Russians, with their early warning system, interpreted as a missile fired from an American Trident sub and thought it was incoming. Called America. We said, no, we didn't shoot anything at you. They said, yes, you did. We said, no, we didn't. They said, yes, you did. We said, no, we didn't. That's as much as I know about the conversation. Yeltsin was handed his briefcase, hadn't been unlocked in 11 years, with a button inside of it. Several military commanders standing around him, encouraging him to hit it. You see, because with ICBMs, coming from that part of the world, once we identify whether this baby's real or not, you've got about 20 minutes to kiss everybody goodbye. So how long did they wait? Last minute, they found out it was a Norwegian weather satellite. Norwegians just want to know what the weather report's going to be, and Yeltsin almost blew the world up. He was probably going, I'm not sure whether I should hit it or not. Flippy coin. So I'm hoping either for the return of Christ, and of course that's my primary prayer. I have children. And whether they die in front of me or not, I'm going to serve Jesus for the rest of my life. I know that. But that's easy for me to sit here and say. I know also that I'm a wimp. I was listening to a tape by Corey Ten Boom. Corey spoke at some of the Calvary. Chuck Smith did Corey's funeral. Corey said, as the German occupation was moving towards her home and they knew that they would be dispersed everywhere, she said, you know, Dad. And he said, don't worry, God will give you the grace. And she said, well, Dad, I don't feel like I'm strong. I don't feel. He said, Corey, when you're going to go somewhere, you're going to get on a train, when do I give you the ticket? And she said, Dad, you give it to me right before I leave. And he said, that's right. And he said, that's when God will give you the grace, when you need it, when you're there. And I trust that he will do that. So I'm hoping for his return. That, to me, is the ultimate optimist in this world. Call me an escapist. I'll call you a stayist. And we'll figure out who's insane and who's sober here. I am an escapist. Do I think that we may see suffering? We may. I don't believe we'll see wrath. I am an avowed pre-tribulationist. We may see America judged and still be here. And I think we have to be prepared for that in our hearts. But if we limp through this, if there's a global recession, a nuke goes off somewhere. If we limp through, I believe that we'll see the greatest time the church has seen in this century. I hope we see 7 services on Sunday. Just people coming just to get warm, maybe. But I'm ready. And I'm an optimist that there are a number of young congressmen and senators, the believers, both Democrat and Republican, that pray daily. I am encouraged that in the Pentagon, there are over 200 believers that fellowship every day. I've been invited to come down and do a chapel this fall in the Pentagon for you can pray for me, because it's a hard thing to know what to say to those guys. But all of the signs are around us. Jesus Christ is coming. He will not forsake us in this. Received this email yesterday. You know what happened in Papua New Guinea just a couple weeks ago with the tidal wave. This message came in from Team Missions, Papua New Guinea. We thought you would like to see an example of God's protecting hand on his own. We want to send you a wonderful true story we just heard. We have missionary friends in Papua New Guinea who were missing after the tidal wave hit on Sunday. We have been fervently praying for their safety. On Tuesday, we received an email from them. It seems that when the warning sounded and they knew there was a tidal wave, the Lord laid it onto their hearts to get into a boat and row towards the wave. Now, you need to know God's speaking to do this, I'm telling you. All the Christians from 3 villages got into their boats and began to row for their lives. The other villagers, the locals, ran into the jungle. Tidal waves are not crashing waves, but rising from underneath the water. The Christians had to literally row uphill in order to get to safety. They were able to crest the wave before it washed on shore. And as the water went back out, their boats were pushed way out to sea. It took them an entire day to row back in. As a result, so far, only 1 Christian man was killed in 3 villages. The rest survived. The missionary said that the unsaved people who had been terribly persecuting the Christians are now all dead. I do not share the story to wish ill against those who are unsaved, of course, who mock God, but to remind us that we serve a mighty God who can protect us from anything, even a tidal wave. We just need to keep rowing. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Now, I'm going to have the musicians come. He dealt with the greatest threat. A nuclear weapon is not the greatest threat to your life. That is only a threat to your physical life. And it won't match the heat described in the Bible in regards to those who suffer eternally separated from God. There is a far worse threat and fate. Remarkably, Jesus came into the midst of our world. took on human flesh, walked among us, and then died in our place. He paid for our sins in his own blood. And I hope this evening, if you don't know Christ, I hope some of this is making you think. See, because this ground that we stand on is not solid. Jesus Christ, he is the solid rock. You can stand on him and go through whatever is ahead of us. And what I want to encourage you to do, if you don't know him personally, we are not playing church. And maybe you grew up in a system playing church. I grew up in a system playing church. My dad was involved with one denomination. My mom was involved with another denomination. I never heard the gospel. Maybe it was preached, but I never heard it. I didn't know he loved me. I didn't know he died for me. I didn't know he was returning, and I didn't know I could know him personally. I didn't know the difference between religion and relationship. And Jesus died on the cross not to leave religious systems or denominations, but to give us life and forgiveness. And what we want to do at the end of the service is we want to make an appeal to those of you who don't know him personally. We're not talking about, you know, you can't stand before God in heaven and say, and if he says to you, why should I let you into heaven? You say, well, I went to Calvary Chapel. He's going to say, never heard of it. No, he heard of it, of course. But my point is this. Look, Calvary Chapel did not die on a cross for you. I didn't die on a cross for you. No minister or priest ever died on the cross for you. No denomination died on a cross for you. Jesus Christ died on a cross for you. If you're the only human being that ever lived, he would have gone to the cross and died for you. And then he would have put the ball in your court. He would have said, now, heaven is available. Though you're a sinner, I took your place in death. I took your punishment in hell. I suffered somehow miraculously, unfathomably, eternity in those 3 hours of darkness. I took your place. When I cried out loud, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? I cried that out loud so you never have to cry it. And he would make the appeal to you and put it before you, because it says that he came to the Jews and the Jews didn't receive him. Came to his own received him not. But to as many as receive him, to them he's given power to become the children of God by a simple act of faith. And it's supernatural. Because your sin was so great, God's holiness is so great, the distance between a sinner and a holy God is so great, that the only thing that could bridge that gap would be a supernatural act. And Jesus Christ accomplished that on the cross when he died in your place. And then he puts the ball in your court. It says, to as many as received him, to them he's given power to become the sons of God. He who has the Son has life. He who hath not the Son hath not life, but is dead already.